Coming up on this week's show, give your Game Gear an audio boost.
The hottest new horror game to hit the Sega Saturn.
And we explore the Italian Amiga demo scene with Paolo Duerso.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every week with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest book, From Ants to Zombies, Six Decades of Video Game Horror? A showcase of horror gaming from the 1970s right up until the modern day across 70 different hardware platforms from the ZX Spectrum to the Xbox Series X. And you can buy that right now and check out the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 402, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show, the podcast that every single Friday takes you back to the classic days of video games. Now, that could be the 1970s, sitting down in front of your telly playing your Atari 2600, maybe the 80s, all those lovely Saturdays spent on your Commodore 64, maybe the 90s in front of your PlayStation 1, maybe the early 2000s, sitting there in front of the fire playing your GameCube. All those memories flooding back. And of course, we'll bring you up to speed on everything that's been happening in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And we bring you a very special guest in the second half of the show. And of course, it is the first podcast of November. You guys got your comfies on, your warm clothes.
You know what? I didn't actually know you were going to ask that, but I actually have a orange blanket wrapped around me right now with pumpkins printed on it. Like, I know it's November now, so, but you know, I am actually a little bit chilly in the old spare room.
I cleared my loft out to get the kind of insulation in there, and I'm like, oh my God, so much retro tech up here. So it's been a discovery of, you know, what I've not realized that I've got up there. And yeah, I found quite a nice PC tower, actually. I was like, oh, wow.
Now we're into this time of year. You know, that means that the Christmas quiz is around 6 weeks away now.
I've got to keep up my kind of reign of being the ultimate loser on the Christmas quiz.
Well, for those people that haven't heard it before, because I mean, we get new listeners coming in all the time. This is like a bit of a retro hour tradition now, isn't it? This will be our, I think this will be the seventh year that we've done this now. So basically we do a complete change of format for our final show of the year each year, the one just before Christmas. And basically we challenge each other to basically a retro battle of the wits, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm worried we're going to run out of questions because we always do 100 questions, don't we? And we try to mix it up every year, like we do teams or we go solo. Sometimes Dan's the quiz master. Our friends Paul and Ollie come on, and sometimes their contestants or they're the quiz master. I'm a mixed bag because I have come last and first.
Yeah, that's because you were on my team. That's why.
Several times. I think every time you've competed, Dan, you've won. I think
it's rigged. I still do.
So, I was going to say, I quite like being the quiz master because then there's no pressure on me.
Yeah, but
it might not happen this year.
We're looking to mix it up again and do something different again this year, aren't we?
So. Yeah, and it's we love the comments we get as well. So many people kind of play along at home as well. So, you know, maybe on that drive home for Christmas, you know, listening in the car, that's always cool. So we're getting into that time of year now. And then, of course, we'll have the best of 2023, even though it feels like this year only started like a couple of months ago. And then, of course, looking ahead to 2024, that won't be far away now. But before we do all that, I mean, actually, this week, we're going to be kind of going back to the summer for me because, you know, we often do retro events across the summer. They've kind of, you know, quietened down for the rest of this year for us now. But we had a pretty packed summer. All of us went to different events all over the place. One of my favourite events that I went to this year was a great little Amiga gathering in Italy, in a small town called Spoleto, which is in the wine region of Italy, in Umbria. And a lovely guy got in touch with me called Paolo. And when I was out there, he's put this event on for a couple of years now, but actually back in the day, in the 90s, he was very big on the Italian demo scene, not only making demos, but also putting on these big parties. I know you'd heard about them, Ravi. They're kind of legendary back in the day.
Yeah, so we...
Amiga Spoleto parties.
Well, Spoletium was the big one, I think, in 2000 and 2001 that I was aware of. And you know, you get these discs that would come out and they'd be like CD-ROMs, actually, on like Amiga format and stuff like that. And I always remember seeing the Italian demo scene and the demo parties. And the demos were always like, some were really technically impressive, but a lot of them were just wacky and crazy and really stylish. And I think the Italian Amiga scene is really interesting. There's a lot of kind of developments that came from there. There's a lot of Amiga fans in Italy as well. And often hear about like Germany and Poland and the UK and Australia and the US, but we don't really focus that much on Italy. And I know there was a lot of Italian Amiga users. So this is a really interesting chat. Remember one of the games that he worked on was Tales from Heaven, which was this kind of, it's kind of like a Mario 64 style game. And I remember it ran on an 040. And I've always found that interesting, you know, games emerging from the demo scene. And of course, in Italy, you've got a Passione Amiga, which is the Italian Amiga magazine. So there's quite a big scene there.
Yeah, I mean, Paolo actually was a founder of Amiga Passione, the magazine out there. That I think he's just actually stepped down from it now, but it is continuing with somebody else. But I mean, this party he invited me out to, I did a little talk there as well. Alistair Brimble was out there with me. Mev Dink was there too. And it was just a great little gathering. I mean, very small, intimate event. You know, the wine was flowing, beautiful Italian food as well. We all went to a lovely restaurant afterwards too. And then me and my missus, who came with me, we spent a few days out there. And Paolo was kind enough to give us like a tour of the region, took us to some of the vineyards and stuff. But on the evenings, he's telling me all these stories about his like Amiga days back in the 90s. And everyone was just incredible. And I said to him, look, we need to get you on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And chat about this. So it's really interesting. So he's actually, he formed a company called Dark Edge Software, who did, like you said, they did some Amiga games back in the late 90s, including Tales from Heaven, which was quite an impressive kind of Mario 64 clone for the Amiga, like you said. And also he's bought the rights recently to one of the worst Amiga games. Are you familiar with Dangerous Streets?
Yes. And yeah,
explain what that is for people that haven't heard of
Dangerous
Streets.
Wasn't it like a CD32 launch title that was just very laggy and kind of really badly designed? I didn't play it that much. I remember the cover though. It was awful. Why has he bought Dangerous Streets?
Well, Dangerous Streets, it was a beat-em-up game that came with the Amiga fighting game. And if you thought Rise of the Robots played badly, try Dangerous Streets. And this was a pack-in that Commodore actually put in the box with the CD32. And basically, he's bought it because he's working on a sequel to it. And he said his intention is to make it even worse than the original if possible.
I love that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So, like you said, always a bit of humour, a bit of tongue-in-cheek with the Italian scene.
It's got 1.9 out of 10 as an average score.
I think that's been generous.
And an 8% on Google.
Yeah. Yeah, terrible.
I wonder how many CD32s that sold.
Not very many by the looks of it. So, Paolo D'Urso is incredible. And if you want to hear all about maybe a sign of the Amiga demo scene and the gaming scene from back in the day that you might not have been all that familiar with, definitely hang around. One for the Amiga fans this week. Paolo is going to be our special guest on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, before that, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening. Another busy week in the world of retro. And let's talk about, obviously, it was Halloween a bit earlier on this week. And there's been a lot of Halloween stories that have been submitted to our Discord. And we've had a few of them sent to us on social media as well, including this rather impressive new horror game, a homebrew game that's inspired by the likes of Silent Hill and Resident Evil, called Cold Case, that is coming to the Sega Saturn.
Yeah, this looks really interesting. So Tommy, one of our longtime followers, sent me this the other day and was like, you need to check it out. And I was like, I've already seen it. It looks fantastic. So as you all probably know, I'm a big fan of, Resident Evil and Silent Hill and the Sega Saturn. So this is right up my street. So this has been made by a guy called Jay Beretta. And I say made, it's still in development. At the moment, it's a demo. And it's been submitted to the 29th annual Sega Saturn Showcase.
Which I hadn't heard of this. This is like a homebrew gaming company.
Yeah.
Like,
is it a game jam?
It looks like it's been going since the Saturn was launching pretty much.
Yeah, so it's still, it's since, like you say, 1994, since the Saturn launched. What it is it's a contest for people to submit homebrews, for a competition and like game jam, and it's on a Sega Extreme forum, and you can go on there and see the submissions and play the demos and stuff. It's a really cool community, and the submissions opened this week, and they end on January 8th, 2024, and then it goes to a vote or something like that. I'm not too sure, but Cold Case has been submitted this week, and really interesting because of obviously graphically the Sega Saturn probably never quite looked as good for 3D as the PS1, but I think they've really captured the kind of Silent Hill vibe
For me, you know, when they're walking around and you're getting areas disappearing and then kind of this like fog that's happening, that's got the Silent Hill vibe for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, everybody's kind of describing this as a Silent Hill Resident Evil. For me, and maybe Dan will agree here, I see it more as Silent Hill meets Alone in the Dark, you know, the original kind of Alone in the Dark.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a bit slower paced, is a bit jittery. And, you know, that might be just because obviously it's being, you know, single-handedly made by this Jay Beretta guy. And, you know, for those, you know, obviously describing a game, it is a tank-controlled third-person survival horror game. You walk around, pick bullets up. But interestingly, you're a detective and kind of how you get around the world is like you will look in a mirror and you will go into the mirror and that will take you to like the next area. And then you will pick up a photograph and you'll look at the photograph in your inventory and it will take you to the area the photograph is. So a church, for example, and it takes you to that church. And obviously there's monsters running around for you to shoot, etc.
It looks like a work in progress. And I guess with, you know, a lot of attention that it's been drawn from this article and stuff, I think maybe he'll probably get some help and stuff. And he's using this engine called the Joe Engine as well, which is an open source
SaaS. Named after Handsome Joe, obviously.
It's just Joe. It's called that.
I don't think it's named after me, but that's cool.
I think this looks awesome. Yeah, really. I mean, I'm looking through, there's like an 8-9 minute video that you can watch by a friend of you guys, actually, Alex, who we know here in Nottingham. His YouTube channel is called The Sega Guru. And he basically gives you a little preview of this because you can download a demo if you want to try it out on your Sega Saturn now, you know, if you can burn it to a disc if you've got a modded system or maybe an SD card reader. And I think it looks quite playable already. I mean, yeah, graphically, obviously, like you said, that the Saturn was kind of geared up differently in terms of 3D graphics to something like the PlayStation. I don't think it used polygons. Instead, it was kind of like squares.
Yeah, I think it used, I can't remember which way around it is, but it either used triangles or it used squares and you had to make a triangle. You had to put two squares together to make a triangle.
It's a PlayStation. Yeah. PlayStation was triangles, and I think, the quads, I think they called it.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's kind of, you know, the voxel kind of shading and stuff on it as well. It's very uniquely a Saturn game if you look at it graphically. You can definitely tell what platform it's running on. But I think, that a lot of people think that aesthetic hasn't aged very well, but I've got a feeling it kind of feels like it's coming back in vogue a bit now.
Yeah.
For retro gamers.
I mean, you know, every couple of months I'm talking about Puppet Combo and, you know, the games, the horror games they're putting out, which are all very Resident Evil. You know, these old school tank control graphics kind of like inspired games. And there's definitely a big community and kind of like, you know, there's a big culture for it, if that makes sense. And it's not just me, you know, rambling about it and stuff like that. There's a lot of people buying these games and playing these mods and playing these games and, you know, putting the videos out for them and getting, you know, a lot of hype about them and stuff like that. So I'm all for it. But yeah, you're 100% right. You know, it's definitely got that Saturn look and, you know, some of the shapes, polygons, if you will, you know, clipping through graphics and stuff like that. But I think it really adds to the charm and the, you know, the style at the time, you know, of the mid-90s and stuff. So yeah, I'm all for it.
And there's already some nice sound effects in there as well. There's, you know, an inventory in there. There's weapons you can pick up. There's enemies in the game already as well. So, you know, it looks like it's pretty far along. So if you want to download that demo, that is free to play now. If you're into Sega Saturn Horror Games, new game called Cold Case. Give it a try for free. Now, while we're on the topic of Sega, we don't cover Sega's handheld beauty enough on this podcast, I don't think. Have you got a Game Gear, Joe? I thought you had one in your collection.
Oh, you've just embarrassed me in front of the whole world.
I haven't got one.
I think Ravi might be selling it, actually.
Yeah, he is, actually. He is. I'm watching it on eBay, but it's probably a bit rich for me because Ravi has a developer's one.
It's collecting dust, you know. I haven't really used it, but when I did use it, this would be a really interesting mod, actually, because I know a lot of the problems with the Game Gear is the audio and the capacitors actually, you know, go quite a lot for the audio. There's a lot of audio mods that are done, but this seems to be a little kind of booster that's come out called the Clean Amp Duo.
Yeah, which I think is a great solution, because that's one thing when we talk about handhelds. I mean, you know, we cover, you know, OLED screen replacements and McWill mods and all that. Generally, the modding community that we see tends to be focused on the visual aspect of it, doesn't it? Putting nicer screens and stuff into retro handheld systems. But I think, yeah, audio is definitely one area that can be improved that doesn't always get as much love, I don't think. And actually, I don't know if you've got much experience with the Game Gear, but it actually does have a really nice audio. Well, nice music can be generated using the Game Gear's audio. You
definitely got that kind of game is that?
Oh, here we go, Joe. It's one for the Christmas quiz. Double Dragon.
I think the audio, you know, when you're coming through the speakers, it sounds all right, but the actual output from the Game Gear, like, you know, through the audio jack, isn't amazingly good. And this actually clears it up as well. So, you know, this gives you like lower beats and higher trebles and stuff, which is really nice. And it's a tiny little device that actually fits inside the case. And it also gives it a 200% boost as well.
Just imagine your mum banging on your bedroom door when you're a kid.
Yeah. Shut that down.
Can you imagine, like, I'd love to just go on a bus with this or something. It just really confuses people.
Blasting out a Double Dragon in the back of the bus 200 times louder.
I just need to say, I did have a Game Gear. I grew up with a Game Gear, and we got burgled.
Well recovered.
We got burgled and it got stolen, and I've just never bought one back because they're always just, they're broken and, you know, they need recapping and stuff like that. Just to put that out there, just to clear my name.
Well, I mean, I've got a Game Gear kind of, again, gathering dust in my cupboard at the moment. Again, it needs a recap. Like you said, I mean, that's everyone I speak to, it's that no one really ever wants to do a Game Gear
recap. It's supposed to be quite an intricate, tricky job as well.
Apparently it stinks as well.
Okay.
Fishy capacitors.
Yeah,
that's right. Because I mean, it's very small and fiddly job to do. And most recappers that I speak to are like, I'll do Amiga's Fire Notorious. Yeah, no problem. Oh, Game Gear, really? Well, I'll do it when I get time. Mm. So I haven't got around to actually getting that sorted yet. I probably should, because I know these things can leak and destroy them.
Well,
so.
Well, this little stereo amplifier has basically got speakers with it as well that give you those extra bass tones. And it's not got much soldering required as well. So if it does get recapped, you know, you'd probably put that in and fit it as well. And it looks like the design of the board is nice enough to kind of just slot in and fit where that audio jack is. So it's pretty much a custom built kit for it. And it's £20, you know, well, £19.20, which is just absolutely great price for a little mod like that. And they do audio mods as well for the Game Boy and other systems.
Yeah, it gives you much cleaner audio. The output's really cleaned up, richer sounding bass. You'll hear tones in games that you didn't hear before, they claim as well. Like you said, you know, much louder too. So I think, yeah, for the sake of £20, I mean, if you're improving your Game Gear, maybe you've already replaced the screen, then why not give the audio some love as well? That's available now from Retro 6, and I will link that up in this week's show notes on your podcast app, or head to the website at theretrohour.com. Now, we all have problems, you know, maybe updating our retro systems. You know, we did cover the new Windows update service is available for like Windows 98 and XP again. So you can update your classic machines. Maybe haven't updated your iPhone in a while. You know, this is stuff that plagues us all the time. But what about doing a remote update from a machine that is 12 billion miles away?
It's pretty tough, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this is NASA's Voyager probes. Now, I know you and I, Ravi, in particular, we've talked about on the podcast before that when we were kids, you know, we're quite nerdy about space. I used to have a telescope in my room. I used to get all the Patrick Moore space books.
Oh, yeah.
I remember getting the NASA 25th year VHS video for one of my birthdays.
I used to get a National Geographic and have the, you know, 3D glasses. Look at all the kind of, you know, different planets and rocks. And I think it was some of the Mars missions and stuff.
And if you're talking about, you know, exploring the solar system, yeah, that's interesting enough. But obviously with the Voyager spacecraft, Voyager 1 and 2, that were launched back in 1977, they've now been going into deep space, interstellar space. They are very far away. I think they're actually the furthest man-made things that have ever left Earth and kind of gone off into space now. But the problem is, I mean, these things, you know, they're rapidly approaching their 50th birthday soon. And I don't know about you, Ravi. I mean, I don't know much about rocket science. That might not be a surprise to most of our listeners. But I'm just amazed that these things are still powered on and running and still have fuel.
Yeah, well, it seems that they're running off plutonium batteries. So I don't think there's much plutonium around anymore. But, you know, they're basically running off plutonium, and they've got a limited life, you know, it's going to run till 2030, but they want to put these updates in there to extend the life. And you're right. They're essentially, you know, small computers that are going around, and of course, you know, 70s technology. So, one thing that I've been watching on YouTube is, there was a fleet of satellites called the, FLT SATCOM, which were released in the '70s and eighties, US government ones. And, they actually, they've had them out, but of course they didn't have any encryption on them. Yeah. And these satellites are basically put out there. And the whole idea was that, you know, the government were the only people that can communicate with it because they were the only people with that kind of range to be able to reach it. But now people can with SDR, which is software-defined radio. And there's all these Brazilian loggers and people that are actually pirating and kind of using these satellites for communication. And there's a channel on YouTube at the moment that we'll put in the show notes that's actually going and like listening to these people pirating and using these old satellites and all sorts of stuff going on in the space wars, you know, that are starting to happen now in the modern world with kind of like warfare, you know, groups are uploading malware to satellites and stuff because it is just essentially a computer that's orbiting the Earth.
But the reason we're talking about this is because, like we said, these Voyager spacecrafts are approaching 50 years old now. They've got stuff on there, you know, some issues like worn-out thrusters and the power levels are decreasing because of, you know, they've been in space for so long. But they're still providing really interesting data from interstellar space that is very valuable to the team at NASA. But actually, they found out it's reporting some, like, problems with, you know, the telemetry, and there are some glitches with the software that it's developed. But they reckon that they can upload a software patch remotely from Earth that should solve some of these problems and also shut down some parts of the system and clear some of the fuel lines as well that hopefully will keep it running for a few more years. So apparently they're working on a patch that is going to be uplinked to Voyager 2 to hopefully fix the computer issue on there. And then if it works well, they're going to put it onto the other one, Voyager 1 as well. I've been looking at some of the hardware that's on board here. These machines actually run on custom-made computers based on the 7400 series of CPUs from Texas Instruments.
Oh, nice.
That were made in 1976. And they're used in, you know, systems like the PDPs. Some of them use them, the mainframes, which is interesting. I mean, you think of that, you know, these systems have been running, up and running. When that left Earth, I mean, you know, the Apple One was just released and the Commodore PET. I mean, that's how old we're talking for them still to develop and do software updates on these machines, you know, never mind the fact that it's so far away from Earth, the fact that these must be some of the longest running computers.
Yeah.
That are running,
you know,
daily.
They went to the moon on a pocket calculator, yeah. Basically with that kind of power. So it's amazing kind of what they've done. And yeah, I just think it's great that you can, you know, do an update that far. It's absolutely insane. And, can't imagine what it's going to be like in the future, and also, you know, what's going to get abandoned and what's going to be able to get used. And I know that there was a BBS satellite up there somewhere as well that you can communicate with, so a ham radio, I think. Yeah, so there's some interesting stuff. I always love a bit of space chat.
Yeah, and never complain about doing Windows updates again. These guys have got to do a much bigger job. So, well, yeah, good luck with the update, the NASA team who are working on Voyager. Now, I love this headline when I read it. I mean, kind of following on from talking about the Sega Saturn a few minutes ago. This headline here is that Abenic is making a Sega Saturn handheld, which is kind of true, kind of not as well. Kind of looks a little bit inspired by the Sega Saturn, and it can run Sega Saturn emulators. But actually, there's quite a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, I read this, you know, and thought, oh, wicked, Sega Saturn handheld, and didn't really kind of think much more of it until I started reading it later on, you know, when I read it tonight, and it was like, oh, okay, so it is just an emulator in there which runs PS1, Dreamcast, and Sega Saturn, and from what I can see, it runs it really, really, really well. But the reason it's kind of capturing, oh, it's Sega Saturn, is because of the controller, the handheld of itself, is based around the Sega Saturn controller, isn't it?
yeah, the kind of styling of it is Sega Saturn. But also, like Abenik, we've had a load of listeners and backers that have said to us, you know, they create some really good handhelds before. And people seem to have had good experience with them and their emulators.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially a handheld Android device. So it can run a lot of emulators on there. Pretty much anything you could run on Android, really. But yeah, I mean, it looks like it's got a pretty nice screen. Like you said, Joe, the main thing about this is that the button layout is heavily inspired, you could say, by the standard Sega Saturn controller in terms of button layout. It's got a D-pad that kind of reminds me a bit of the D-pad you might get on an Xbox 360 controller. It looks a bit like it might be lifted off one of those. And also the colour schemes as well. I mean, they're showing one here on this article on gamesradar.com that I'll link up as well, which is kind of in the colour of the Japanese Sega Saturn, isn't it? That kind of white colour.
Yeah, they've got the, they have, if you scroll through them, they have got the, you know, the PAL American black one as well. But yeah, the Japanese one seems to be the one people are talking about, you know, grab the headline, if you will, and you know, it's got the colourful buttons and, you know, the green, yellow and blue buttons. And then it's got the, you know, the maroon, purple start and select and shoulder buttons with the white case. And it does look really, really nice. But essentially, for me, what it comes down to, and I'm not bashing it. I'm all for these, you know, these handheld emulators. And it is making me think it's about time I probably get one. It comes down to is it looks like the Japanese Sega Saturn one.
Yeah.
That controller. That's what it comes down to.
And they also do them in various different colours as well. I see there's like a blue version of it. There's also, one thing that kind of catches my eye, there's like a translucent version as well. We don't get transparent plastics enough anymore.
No, we don't. Me and my brother were talking about that the other day, our old translucent Game Boy Pocket. And we were saying we missed that era of the 90s where everything was translucent. Your phone, you know, even your blow-up chairs and stuff like that.
Yeah. I used to have a transparent house phone. Nice. Light up when someone was making a phone call back in the day. That was pretty cool. Do we know pricing on this yet? So at the moment, it looks like there's a YouTube channel that's kind of showing a teaser trailer, but I'm not sure whether. So I imagine with this kind of thing, they're generally not all that expensive, these little kind of handheld Android
devices.
It
doesn't look like there is one. I always find these go one way or the other. They're either generally very cheap, but, you know, still decent quality, or they tend to be on the completely other side. Like,
well, looking on the site, you know, some of the other ones that they've got, $87 and some go down to 59 and then some are up to like 137.
Yeah.
Which, you know, sounds reasonable for what it is, I think. And again, it's, you know, I remember when these Android kind of handhelds first came out, you know, when we were first covering them like 5-6 years ago, generally at most they could kind of cover, they could run like, you know, maybe Mega Drive and Super Nintendo games. They all struggle a bit when you got to like the 32-bit generations, but it seems like now they're saying that it can run Nintendo 64. Oh, and Dreamcast games on here even. So, you know, they're definitely coming along a long way. So, hopefully not too expensive and a nice little way to play 32-bit games on the go. So if you want to check out that little teaser trailer, I'll shove that in our show notes as well. Now, this is something that I've been seeing quite a lot of, actually. Not all in a positive way. So it'll be interesting to hear what you guys think of this. Because Data East's gory 90s brawler, Night Slashers, is getting a full remake treatment with visuals that seem to be dividing fans somewhat.
Sorry, that name just reminds me of going to the toilet at
night. At 4 a.m.
That is brilliant. So, I am torn here. Like, so I'm a fan of Night Slashers. I feel like Night Slashers is such a underrated kind of, like, I don't want to use the word hidden gem, but it's, you know, it never got a home port. It was a beat 'em up in the arcades in, I want to say, 93. It came out side-scrolling, you know, belt-scrolling, beat 'em up in the vein of, you know, Final Fight, Streets of Rage, and it was by Data East.
Yeah.
And the selling point of it is it's really gory. You know, imagine Splatterhouse kind of like visuals. You could pick, you know, three characters. I think it was three players as well. And, you know, you could be like a magician kind of vampire Van Helsing kind of guy, or you could be this little ninja girl, or you could be the big slow guy who had like big metal arms, and you fight zombies and vampires and werewolves and Frankenstein's monsters and stuff. But it's got a real like 80s, early 90s horror film charm to it. Like,
yeah,
you know, when you beat these zombies up, like you smash their faces in, and when their bodies fall on the floor, they turn to gunge and melt away. And It's got that real like kind of like kind of like sound effects to it.
And squelchy.
Really squelchy, and you could get swords and knives and chop people up and stuff. Really, really, really over the top kind of pixelated gore. And yeah, they're remaking this, and this has been rumored since 2021. This has been rumored since that Forever Entertainment have got their hands on it. And they were behind the remakes of Panzer Dragoon, House of the Dead, and Front Mission. And I'll admit, I wasn't massively impressed with the House of the Dead remake.
I remember you saying on the show, actually.
Yeah, I was really excited for it. And I wasn't that impressed with it, unfortunately. And I know I'm usually quite a positive guy with these things. And I'm sure I'll pick this up as well, because like I say, I'm a fan of Night Slashers. I've never played it in the real arcade. I've only ever played it on, you know, on MAME and Pandora and stuff like that. But graphically, yes, it looks pretty much like Streets of Rage 4. You know,
which again was something that divided fans. A lot of people hated that kind of flat kind of comic book style almost.
Yeah. And, you know, I know I get that's kind of like where we've gone with things, but they've really toned down the violence of it, and they've really toned down the animation of it, because it's like watching the trailer here, when you kill the zombies, you know, they just flash away, you know, like on the floor. They don't melt away. There's no squelching. There's no like none of that kind of gunge gore or anything like that. And it's just like they seem to have reduced the frames of animation, you know, in the last 30 years. Like it's weird, you know. And I heard an expression which I'm going to butcher the other day, and it's like, back in the day with the pixel graphics, people would use the pixels and the old graphics to try and make the most beautiful looking game they could possibly make. And now when people do these kind of like pixel or hand-drawn graphics which are inspired by it, they try to make it look as basic as they can and get away with it.
Right.
And I feel that's what's happened here. Gameplay wise, it looks perfectly fine. Don't get me wrong, it looks like a solid beat 'em up. I just think Night Slasher's charm was the fact that it was really over the top gory, you know. And don't get me wrong, there's still zombies with their arms and faces hanging off and stuff, but it's just not very interactive by the looks of things, unfortunately.
Well, there is a comment here that it kind of sums it up, really. So someone said it looks like a 2008 Adobe Flash game.
Yeah.
That you're playing the web browser, you know, stylistically, the look of it. And I must admit, I hadn't played this game before, but I went onto YouTube to check out what the original looked like. And it is a gorgeous looking game from 1993, you know, graphically beautiful. And then I followed a few links, and people are like, well, you know, you can download it on the Nintendo Switch. It's on the eStore.
It's on the eStore.
And I went on there, but actually, they've deleted it now.
Oh, the original. Of course they have.
So obviously, in preparation for this coming out, I imagine.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I looked at it, I thought that looks fun. I wouldn't mind downloading that on my Switch, the original, but I guess I want people playing the new version now, which at the time of recording, they haven't confirmed which platforms it's going to be available for. But I mean, generally these kind of games always come out on the Switch at least, don't they? And probably PS4, PS5. No release date as yet as well. You know, they kind of missed out on the Halloween season by the looks of it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the only thing this has really done for me is make me want to play the original.
Yeah, I mean, try and emulate it, download it or something. You know, it's a basic beat 'em up. It's not got, you know, it's, you know, punch and jump and then hold the two buttons together and you do a special kind of thing. You know, there's a few magic specials in there. The main selling point of it was the visuals, and it is. It's just a wicked looking, you know, horror game, you know, but it's a beat 'em up, and which is just, you know, two of my favorite things put together. And I'm sat here like, I'm 100% going to buy it, the new one, and play it, and, you know, probably enjoy it for what it is. But I think some attention to detail to the gunge and, you know, people melting away, etc. I mean, to be fair, I'm looking at the original, they do flash away, but, you know, after you kill them, I'm watching it now, but you punch their heads off or you punch them in half and then they land on the floor and flash away kind of thing. Didn't see much of that in the new one.
Yeah, if anything, they should make it more gory,
You
know, with the graphical advancements.
Absolutely. Take a leaf out of Mortal Kombat. Maybe they're reading
Well, there you go. Maybe they're reading the comments and they're going to take some on board. I mean, it's not out yet, so, you know, it's time for stuff to change. So if you want to check that out, if you've never played that game, though, maybe it's going to, you know, spur a few people to check it out, or the original game like me. So Night Slashers is the name of the game, and I'll link that little trailer up. And, of course, everything else we talk about, I save you the job of Googling around. I put them all in the show notes. Just have a look on your podcast app or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, we are into November. A good little reminder to everyone that we'll only be a couple of weeks until our next Patrons Hangout that we do at the end of the month. You know, that's going to come around quickly. And then it'll be into the Christmas season. So if you'd like to join us for it, we had a really good one this weekend just gone, didn't we? We talked about so many different things.
I dressed as David Brent.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a Halloween party.
Still can't get the grease out of my hair.
Well, I was pleased he did because I came on the... Because basically, if you haven't joined us for our Patrons Hangout before, we send out a Google Meet link to all our patrons so everyone can come on. Basically like a massive Zoom call, isn't it? We all get together for a couple of hours, last Sunday of the month usually, and just, you know, geek out about all things retro and tech and stuff. And I thought, well, with it being like day before Halloween, I'll wear a Halloween costume. So I had my Ghostbusters outfit on and stuff. And I came on and had that shocking realization that nobody else was actually dressed up at first. And you never want to be that knobhead that turns up to the party, the only one that's in fancy dress, do you?
To me, there was a luckily, few people by the end
yeah,
of it.
There was, luckily, yeah. But Ravi came on to be the second knobhead to dress up, so I was quite pleased about that. And then, yeah, there was a few more as well, so I didn't feel so bad in the end. But yeah, I mean, it's always just a giggle, isn't it? We all just have so much fun on the
hangout. It was interesting. We went for a series of topics, and we ended up talking about theme parks as well, which is always good to hear different people's stories and, you know, about experiences from theme parks around the world as well.
Yes, I mean, we cover all kinds of stuff as well, all showing off new pickups and, you know, I hear about so many things that I wasn't aware of, you know, add-ons for old systems. We're talking about 3DO SD card readers and, you know, all kinds of topics on it. So if you want to join us for this month, now would be a very good time to sign up to our Patreon. You'll get an invite to it at the end of the month. And also you get some other perks for being a patron of this podcast too. Obviously you're helping us keep the lights on. So in return, we give you a longer podcast each week. We're about to do another two or three news stories just for our patrons. You get the show ad free. If I can get out early to patrons, I do try my best. You know, some weeks I get it edited a bit early, so I get it out to you on time. And also, if you join us as a gold member or above, you get access to all 38 episodes of our special bonus secret podcast called The Retro Hour After Hours, where we've covered all kinds of things on here. I mean, I've been looking back through the list of the last 38 episodes. Most recent ep, we've done the retro years, going back to 1995. We did the most overrated games. We had a bit of a mastermind quiz a couple of months ago. We did one all about video game piracy. We talked about Amiga games we still play, the best multiplayer games, the Nintendo 64 special, all episodes that we've done over the last few months. And if you'd like to get access to all 38 episodes of that, if you join us on Patreon now, you get a little link to unlock them all as well. So really, if you enjoy what we do, great way to support the podcast and make sure that we can continue into 2024. Okay, then next, we're going to go inside the world of the Italian Amiga demo and gaming scene from back in the day with this week's special guest, the wonderful Paolo D'Urso, is coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And you know that Ravi and I always love geeking out about the Amiga and the demo scene. And our guest this week does as well. A lovely guy who I had the pleasure of hanging out with in Italy very kindly invited me to this wonderful event that he put on out there that, of course, I was talking about on the podcast a couple of months ago, the Passione Amiga Day. And I thought I'd welcome on the organiser as well because we actually had a few late-night chats in the various cafes and bars around Spoleto, all about his history with the Amiga, which was just fascinating. So I thought I'd have him on the podcast to talk a bit more about him. So let's welcome on Paolo D'Urso, also known as Modem on the scene as well, from Dark Age Software, the Amiga scene group X-Zone back in the day. He's a coder, musician, writer, and event organizer as well. So welcome to the podcast, Paolo.
Hi, everyone. So nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, really nice to have you on. Like I said, you know, we had some fascinating late night chats over some delicious wine in Spoleto last month, talking about your history with the Amiga. So it's very nice to have you on the podcast to do some reminiscing with us. And we always like to kind of find out where our guest journey began. So, I mean, what initially got you interested in computers? Where did the whole thing start?
We are talking about secondary school, and it was something like 10 years old when a friend of mine, we all had in or Nintendo NES or Atari 2600, and a friend of mine told me like, that's nothing. You should come to my home. I have an Amiga. The graphic is something unbelievable, better than the arcade rooms. And I was like, seriously? Okay. Okay, I will come this afternoon with a friend of mine. And we were shocked. The first time I saw an Amiga in action, it was something unbelievable. This friend of mine was right. The graphics, the sound was better than the arcades. So I had to wait 1 year before to get an Amiga. And then I started to play like crazy. And I found out that in my small town, there was a demo group called Soft One. They were bigger than me. And they used to meet in the only computer store in the afternoon. And I was going there and I was asking them, can you teach me how to program video games or demos? And, you know, the 90s. So they were like, yeah, sure. Come outside and behind the store. We will teach you. And they were beating me like crazy because they were like, what do you want to learn? Pam, pam. And I was like, I want to learn programming. Pam, pam. And they were beating me like there is no tomorrow.
I was wondering what the Amiga scene was like in Italy then, because did Commodore have like a big presence there?
You know, we were always looking, the demo sceners from Italy, we were looking at the north of Europe. So Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and we were like, wow, okay, must be really cold there. So they have time to stay at home and learn how to make great effects. And in Italy, it was always so warm. So should I spend another afternoon working on some routines? Let's go out and play soccer.
Well, I mean, obviously, Paolo, I mean, as well as, you know, the stuff you do on the Amiga, you're a very accomplished musician as well. I know you've had over 22 albums. You've played over 1,200 live concerts as well. I mean, did you start using your Amiga when you got one for music when you were a kid?
To be honest, no. To be honest, I used the Amiga to make video games. I started with Amos, sorry, my Italian accent is getting...
Either works.
And I was selling my video games at school to my classmates. And in my school, everybody had an Amiga. Everybody had an Amiga here back in the times. Then when in 2002, I decided to quit the Amiga world because I was really pissed off by the Amiga Inc., by the decision. You remember this Amiga Anywhere and Amiga DA, and I was like,
when they were trying to kind of do a Java style thing, and this was very much after SCOM, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I was like, oh no, I don't like this anymore. Okay, I'm out. And I wanted to really do something different, so I started to work on music. It took me some time before I became a professional musician. But now those times are already almost over. So I came back to Amiga, to programming, and I found out that Amiga is really like a good bottle of wine. So it gets better aging.
Well, where would you buy an Amiga then in Italy? Would there be like a retail shop, or would there be any Italian Amiga companies?
The Commodore Italia was very strong. I remember always watching on TV, on national channels, advertising about Amiga and Commodore. So in the computer store in our town, they were basically only Amiga for sale. They were selling also PC, but in the window and inside they were hundreds of Amiga boxed games and Amiga models. So, and then, yes, we had a lot of stores that were making advertising on video game magazines. We, by the way, in Italy, we still have the Games Machine, which just celebrated the 400th issue, and it's the longest living video game magazine in the world. And still, believe it or not, they started writing again about Amiga. And in every issue, they have 16 pages about Amiga. This is incredible.
16 pages on a mainstream gaming magazine the Amiga. Wow.
Yeah, you can find the Games Machine in every newsagent. They have a very good distribution, and the quality of the magazine is really, really high. Also, we have also in Italy Zap magazine, again, which is not a translation of the British edition. Actually, the old Italian Zap writers started again to publish the magazine. You need to have a subscription, so you cannot buy Zap on newsagents. As well, like Passione Amiga, the other Amiga magazine we have. But still, this is a very good sign. This is really a very good sign that people need the paper. I love to read magazines on paper when I'm when I sit on the toilet or when I'm at the beach. So,
I mean, kind of taking it back to, you know, when you first got involved in the demo scene in the 90s, because I mean, I remember, you know, like most kids, playing games on my Amiga was like the main thing that I did when I first got it. And then going into my local computer store, and they sold public domain discs in there, and picking up one that they were showing on the machine of like, I still can't remember what demo it was, but I remember seeing the effects and just being fascinated by it. How did you discover the Amiga demo scene yourself, and what kind of drew you into it?
Well, I remember that those guys, the Soft One guys, this demo group from my hometown, they were bringing some effects on floppy disks to show in the computer store. Like, ah, oh, look, I did this effect, this and that. And I was like, can you play with that? No, it's not a video game. And bam, they were beating me again. But then one of them, copied some demos to me, and he gave me four or five floppy disks. And he told me, like, look at these ones, then you will start to understand what we're talking about. And oh my God, I was really shocked. So my goal was no more to make video games on Amiga, but was to make demos. And I needed to learn assembler. And I remember that I contacted one guy living in Tuscany that was in the demo scene, and he was very good with assembler. And I wrote him and asked, can I come a few days to your town and I will book a hotel and you will teach me something? I will pay for it. And he was like, yeah, sure. So that's where I started. And oh my God, assembler was so complicated at the beginning because I was used with Amos. So open screen, open, and bam, the screen is open. But with assembler, you had to reserve memory, then the copper list, and everything.
Yeah, going from Amos, it was a variation of BASIC, wasn't it, Amos? And then obviously assembler. I mean, I remember, you know, I think I got a demo disc of that DevPack, which was an Amiga assembler on the front cover of Amiga Format magazine, and just trying to follow the tutorials, but my head just couldn't get in that space. It is very complicated.
Yeah, yeah. And me and my friends, we founded a demo group called the X Zone, and we started to release some intro, some BBS tro. We had a guy that was running a BBS back in the days, and we were so happy because at some point, some guys on IRC from Sweden contacted us, like, we like your productions, we would love to join, and we would love to open a Swedish section of X Zone. And we were so excited, like, wow, because they are from Sweden, they know how to make demos, they must be cool. And we lost the control of the group, basically, because they started to release some very, very lame stuff, and they let something like 50 people join that we didn't know who they were. And they were like, oh, terrible demo sceners. So in 1994, we decided to leave the group and to found a new one, being much more careful. And the name was Dark Age. And there we started really somehow. Some people from another demo group, Ram Jam, which is an Italian demo group, which was like, wow, the main one, decided to join Dark Age. And this was a really, wow, exciting for us. And the quality started to be better and better and better. And then we started to work also again on some commercial software. And that's all the story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just thinking of kind of where you grew up, because I mean, obviously I was out there the other week in Spoleto, an ancient city in, you know, the wine district of Italy, in very central Italy, but it's a very small place, isn't it? So, I mean, kind of thinking about, you know, the Amiga scene there, I mean, were there a lot of kind of Amiga sceners around you locally?
Yes, yes. Spoleto is a town with 35,000 inhabitants. And there were a lot of people not only owning an Amiga, but doing something with Amiga. So we found a graphic artist. We found one guy that also was a coder, and better than me, by the way. And we found two guys that were making music. And then a classmate was doing music as well. So Everybody, Amiga was really multimedia. Well, thanks to Deluxe Paint, Pro Tracker, and Amos or Asmuan, the assembler, everybody was able to do something. And now it's easy, you know, like, okay, I can run PowerPoint and do something or Photoshop. But back in the days, Amiga was the only computer where you could really easily create something. That was some magic of Amiga. So even if I'm not from Rome or Milan, there was a very strong Amiga user base here in Umbria.
I was wondering, you know, you mentioned the Scandinavian countries there as well, and they had a very big identity with the demo scene. What was the identity with the Italian scene? What kind of stood out, and what was your style?
All the Italian demo sceners started to do it for fun mostly. So even this group Ram Jam had a section called the Bloody Fires Design. they were releasing some very serious demos like It Can't Be Done, which is a fantastic demo for Amiga 1200. And we as well, we started to release a serious stuff under the Dark Age label. And also we had a parallel demo group. And we were, under different nicknames, we were releasing really silly stuff. Because we knew we could never reach the level of quality of the Scandinavians. That's why.
Well, back in the day, I mean, you went under the demo scene handle, and obviously everyone on the demo scene needed a catchy handle. You went by the name Modem. So, I mean, why did you pick that name, and were you immersed much in early online culture?
Well, I chose that nickname because I had a modem at home. So I could connect on internet. And at that times, you had to connect to the bank, to one of the banks, and the banks were giving you internet connection. And then from the banks, I found a way to connect illegally to some connections and basically to be always online without paying.
Nice.
Yes. And oh my gosh. And then a friend of mine found the same method, and he started to buy hard disks over hard disks and to download a lot of cracked stuff from some BBS from Venezuela, something like that, until the police catched him. But I was very lucky because actually I was more interested in the demo scene. So for me, it was like, okay, let's go on IRC where I can chat with those Scandinavians, because they were all online. From Italy, nobody was online at that time.
Yeah, we were talking about that before, the fact that, you know, you kind of miss those IRC days, you know, even though Discord, obviously a lot of people are on there, doesn't quite have the same feel that IRC had.
Yes, exactly. I miss very, very much the IRC days. And recently I switched on one old Amiga of mine, which has an hard disk, and I found some logs of some chat on IRC, and I was very nostalgic of those times. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm too old, but I cannot enjoy Discord. Somehow it doesn't have the same feeling, and Facebook as well. I can chat. Mm. Now they added this feature of this public chats on Facebook, but I don't know, they don't smell good to me.
Yeah, it feels a bit sterile and corporate, doesn't it, still? I guess that's the difference, yeah, rather than the homebrew nature of IRC. I mean, talking about, you know, the productions that you worked on back in the day as well. So obviously, you know, 1994, you founded your group. What were some of the productions that you worked on initially, and kind of what memories have you got of those early productions that you made?
Oh, I was so happy because I focused on working on intros, because for me, an intro is a challenge stronger than a demo, because you are very limited with the kilobytes.
Explain what an intro is to people that might not have heard of them.
Oh, yes. An intro is like a demo. So it's a sort of abstract video clip, let's say, where everything you see is made in real time. So there are no pre-calculated animations. And while a demo back in the days could be on one or even more than one floppy disk, an intro has a limit of size of 4 kilobytes, 40 kilobytes, 64 kilobytes, depending of the competition. And I loved to do an intros in 40 kilobytes because then all the music had to be really minimal, the graphics as well, and the programming. You really had to optimize your code. And I was somehow, I don't want to say I was good in that, but I was decent to do that.
Were there any like demos that you saw that really stood out to you that kind of acted as inspiration and that you remember today?
Oh, I was really shocked when I saw State of the Art by Spaceballs and then Nine Fingers by the same group. And those were like, wow, video clip. I loved also Jesus on S, which was a demo, I don't remember, if 20 minutes long, something like really unbelievable. Mm. And I loved, of course, World of Commodore 92 from Sanity. And what else? Then I have to say that at the second half of the 90s, people were leaving the Amiga demo scene because Commodore failed, not everybody trusted ESCOM and Gateway, so people just left the platform. But I really have good memories of demos of 96, 97, 98. One demo that I really like, and I know it's not that popular, it's a demo from Ram Jam, Massive Killing Capacity. Massive Killing Capacity, right, is a demo released in 96. And in my opinion, it's one of the highest quality Italian demos on the Amiga. And then, of course, other demos which were, for me, like, wow, amazing. The Black Lotus demos, like Capture Dreams, Tint, Goa, which are from 96, 97, 98. And I was strong at that time in the Amiga demo scene. I knew all the demo sceners. And for me, it was like, okay, I was on IRC or I was going to some demo parties, but it was like meeting with really close friends. That was much more than just programming. It was like, wow, that's the community I want to be part.
Was there a kind of time when the demo scene split away from the piracy scene? In the UK, we had a lot of the, you know, kind of Cracktros and stuff like that. Was there any point where they kind of split off?
Yes. I have to say that the demo scene comes from the crack scene because it was a challenge to maybe on a floppy disk, you just had 4, 5, or 10 kilobytes free, and the crackers had to crack the game and also to in those little space to add a crack throw. So a sort of intro where they were promoting like, look, we cracked this game, we were the first ones. Some groups like Fairlight, Scoopex, Razor 1911, they were making crack throws. But after that, the demo scene took its own way when people started to realize like, okay, these effects I see on screen, these are very beautiful. Sometimes they were even more beautiful than the game itself. Mm. So people start to realize, okay, we can really do some kind of art on that. Now it's easy to create art. You just go on AI and you type, okay, draw an image with this characteristic with the Roger Dean style or I don't know, any artist style, and bam, you have an image or even a video. But in the 90s, you had to create everything by yourself. So the demo scene, and now I'm very happy that finally is recognized by UNESCO. The demo scene was really a group of clever artists that were even doing that for free using nicknames, not even their real names.
And it's interesting, the culture around it as well. I mean, you mentioned then that you used to attend demo parties. So what parties did you used to attend, you know, in the 90s, and what are some of your best memories of going to parties?
Oh, I have one story to tell. I was not going well during high school because I was spending most of my time programming on Amiga. So when I asked to my parents, because I was 17 years old, can I go to Paris to Saturn party because I have an intro that I believe it will win the competition? They told me, of course, no, because your results are really bad. So no, you have to stay at home and study. But I really wanted to go to Saturn Party in Paris. So I told to my parents, listen, I will go for the weekend to study together at the house of a friend of mine, and we will study because also his results are not good. And then I jumped on the train and I went to Florence when I met another demo singer, and we went with his car to Paris. And we didn't have mobile phones back in the time. And during that weekend in Umbria, because we are this region, the central region of Italy, is very seismic. We had a major earthquake and many people died and many houses collapsed. It was a tragedy. And I didn't knew anything because I was in Paris at the party where I arrived second, by the way.
And, oh, wow.
And I called my mom like on Saturday afternoon. And my mom was like, oh my God, you're alive. And I say, yeah, mom, I'm very tired because I'm studying a lot. How are you? Mom, I told you I'm tired. And how's your friend? Oh, okay. And the family and everyone. I said, mom, why are you so worried? We're just studying. I know I never studied before, but it's okay. I can do it. And then I found out. And then she told me, how was the earthquake? Was it strong? And I was like, oh my God, probably they had an earthquake. They didn't knew how strong. And I was like, no, we didn't feel it.
Yeah. So you didn't get busted then by your mom.
And then I wrote, 1 year ago, I wrote a book about all the Amiga memories. And it's called the Dark Age Software, the History. At the moment, it's only in Italian language because I did it mostly for my child, to don't lose the memories, because I have two small kids, and when they will be big, I will look at their eyes, I will be old, and like, what's this old computer, Amiga? So I wrote this, and I gave them last Christmas as a present to my parents and my mom. Ah, that's why. Okay, you told me you didn't feel that earthquake. She did remember that episode.
Nice. Well, I was wondering how long it generally took to put a demo together, and how did you go about planning it?
I will tell you about the latest demo I released, because I came back to the Amiga demo scene, and I released this year at Revision Demo Party an Amiga demo called Neo Colora, which also arrived second. And nice. Well, I haven't touched the assembler, Amiga assembler, for 20 years. And at the beginning, it was incredibly difficult. I didn't remember even how to edit the startup sequence on Amiga. But it took me something like 6 months, working almost every evening on it. So, yeah. And when I was in the 90s, I would say the same. Yeah, 6 months is a good time.
Did you ever plan them out on like paper or anything then, or was it just straight into the computer?
Straight to the computer. I just in the 90s, I found some paper books where I was writing some code in Amos when my parents were not letting me use the Amiga. Then I was programming on paper and then copying on Amos and see if it worked.
Very cool. Well, I know that you've done a lot of productions over the years, and one thing that you're kind of famed for is kind of putting hidden Easter eggs in demos, you know, even like the 4K ones as well. I mean, tell us about some of the hidden stuff that you put in there, and why did you do that?
Oh, yes. I remember, for example, that I had some discussions on IRC with some other demo singers, and I didn't want to start a real flame, so I didn't put some hating stuff. Only, you know, inside the demo, you can put some greetings, and normally you greet the other demo groups, or some bad words against a specific demo singer. But I didn't want to start a public flame, so I almost always added some secret part, and then I started to write really bad stuff to back in the times. Like,
how did you access these then? Were they like kind of secret key combinations or clicking certain bits of the screen?
I use always the method click the right mouse button during the demo.
Right. That easy.
Basic, yes.
Well, one thing I used to, you know, reading like demo scene disc mags back in the day, they were, you know, really popular on the demo scene. And you often had, you know, similar to the music charts commercially, there was a demo scene chart that would come out regularly. I mean, did the demo scene charts mean much to you back in the day? Was it quite, you know, a good feeling if you made it into them?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The Italian demo scene was full of people, even though we didn't have great talents like the Scandinavians. But we had a lot of magazines, for example, in Italian languages. One was called Infamia, and they also had, or and another from the generation. We had a lot of Italian disc magazines, and very often I was in part of the best coder and best organizer charts. And for me, it was like fuel on my engine. I needed them to go on and make more demos, more stuff. And also, we were. My group, Dark Age, was working on Showtime, which was a disc magazine started by Ram Jam, this legendary Italian demo group. And then after three issues, they were tired, they were older than us. So they told me, do you want to take this magazine? And it was like, of course. And we released the 17 issues, and we also had the demo charts. So best coder, best graphic artist, best musician. Of course, I wasn't in those charts because there are a lot of people better than me. But it was really, I could really feel that everybody wanted to be in there. It was really a good method to keep the demo scene alive.
Well, the interesting thing was I always thought, you know, demo scene groups are ideal for releasing games because they know what they're doing with coding and can create some quite ambitious stuff. One was Tales from Heaven, which you worked on, which I remember worked pretty well on an Amiga 040. What was the process of developing that, and how did you get involved?
Oh, yes. I had a good contact with a Spanish, Ruben Elcaniz, which is a Spanish programmer and a Spanish demo scener. And he showed me his 3D engine, which was like, wow, wonderful. Because most of the 3D engines in the demos are very tricky. Like, okay, they run fast, but there are no collisions. There are no possibility to be managed by joypad or keyboard and so on and so on. But his 3D engine was really made. It was made for a demo, but it could work for a game. So I told him, like, okay, why don't we show the world that Amiga can have a 3D platform game like Mario 64. And he was like, yes. I had contact with Epic Marketing at the time because I was working already for them. And I told them about the project. And they asked, can you show us a demo of it? We will sponsor it, but we need to see first. So we prepared a first demo of the game with one level. And they were like, oh my God, we want this. And they waited long because then the development time took 2 years. And at the end of 2000, the Amiga market was shrinking very, very much. So Epic told us, guys, we waited 2 years, but now is really time to release the game. And we knew, the development team, knew that the game still needed the one extra year of development to work on playability. Because the game looks okay, but the playability didn't satisfy us. And the Epic told us, guys, we need to release because the market is dying, now or never. So let's release it, and then maybe we will make a bug fix or an update, but actually we never did it.
There was always that kind of idea with Amiga that, you know, Amiga couldn't do 3D, and that was what a lot of people said. And I think the demo groups actually came around and proved that was completely wrong.
Absolutely, absolutely. The graphic mode of Amiga works in planar mode, and to do 3D stuff, you don't need, but it's much better if you work in chunky mode. So the Amiga was lower anyway because you needed to make a software conversion planar to chunky. And also, Amiga has the possibility to have three kinds of RAM, of memory. And the graphic chipset of Amiga only works with the slow, with the cheap RAM, which is slow. So these two aspects were always a problem for developers because after Doom was released, everybody wanted 3D. I don't know if you remember that moment where Amiga we had a wonderful two-dimensional platform games or adventure games, and nobody was caring about them anymore. Because everybody wanted 3D. But of course, to make a 3D game on a plain Amiga 1200, it was a bit complicated. And then the market, then Commodore failed and market shrank. It was like, a lot of negative stuff. But we wanted to prove. Also, at that time, there were a lot of demos with very nice 3D engines. So at that time, I felt that there wasn't yet a big gap. Also, with Amiga, I could connect on internet easily. I had a BVision graphic card, and which was super fast. So actually, my friends with PC, they were coming to my home, and they were looking at my Amiga, and they said, like, this is a modern PC. I say, no, this is an Amiga. And they were like shocked, like, wow. So
upgraded heavily.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're right. I mean, by the time we got to 2000, I mean, I remember, you know, Amiga Format magazine here in the UK, you know, closed down early 2000. It felt like the Amiga market was really kind of shrinking then because of, you know, the stuff you mentioned before about all these promises that were being made that, you know, the parent company Amiga Inc. didn't deliver on. And I know around that time after Tales from Heaven, you've also worked on some unreleased Amiga titles as well. I read that you worked on a game called The Golem and also a shooter game called Alive. So can you tell us a bit about those games, and is there much left of them today?
About The Golem, I was only working as a programmer for another company. It wasn't my project. And right. The company opened. They were renting offices. They were quite serious. I mean, they looked serious. And I remember that they asked me to work as a programmer. And Aud Vannitorelli, which was Aud Dark Age, was also a demo singer, to be the to make the music for that game. And we started to work on it, but then the contract they made wasn't the best, so we asked for a better contract and we left the company. It was a company made by two cousins. One was the graphic artist behind The Golem, and the other was I think he worked as a policeman or something like that, and he was basically sponsoring the company. So probably at some point they decided to cancel the project and close the company before the game was released, because also they realized that the Amiga market was too small, and on PC there were different kind of games, so that game couldn't work on PC.
I remember there was a bit of hype around it at the time because they'd released like a little FMV or like a little, you know, video of it.
And, yeah,
all the magazines were going crazy, I remember.
Yeah, the game was made in Amos, by the way, not Union Assembler. Yes. About Dark Age Software, we were working on a shoot 'em up called Alive, which now you could call it my English pronunciation now is going to be very bad. Roguelite. So basically, everything arrives on the screen and you need to shoot. So no scrolling, nothing, just bam, 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 bam. We found a way to show something like 60 sprites at the same time at 50 frames per second. And I'm very sorry that game wasn't released because it was looking very nice. And the programmer of that, I was directing that project. I wasn't programming it personally. And the programmer of that game now is one of the lead programmers of TripAdvisor. He lives in the UK and we still have contact. He's a very, very talented programmer. And I asked him, maybe do you have still the sources of that game? Because I could complete it. And he told me like, yeah, but they are in Rome on my Amiga 4000. And I don't know when I will come back to Rome. To Italy again, so I'm just waiting to see if I
can. That needs a road trip to recover that. Then I'd love to play that game.
Exactly, because I can tell you, it's really even now it would be like wow. The graphics, I have all the graphics, all the music I found on my hard disk, everything. I just released recently about Alive. If you are curious to see something, I released the intro, the executable file of the intro, and all the graphic assets on our web portal, which is called games that weren't.com. So if you go there and you search Alive, you can watch the intro, all the first part, and all the graphics.
And I hope that hard disk in your friend's Amiga 4000 still works, because it would be amazing to finally get that game out there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I was thinking to make it with the Scorpion engine, actually.
Yeah.
Eventually. But then time is always so short. So this is, we will see. We will see. If Alive, the game will be really alive.
Well, I also read that you worked briefly with Team 17. I mean, what was the story there?
No, we had some contacts, but nothing happened. I was working for Epic Marketing, and but now I'm very happy, because life is always bringing a lot of presents, unexpected presents that are so beautiful, and I always in my life wanted to shake the hand of Alistair Brimble, the music artist of Team 17. And 30 years later, he was in my home, and we had lunch together, we opened bottles of wine together, and we are friends. And this is one of the best presents I received in my entire life. So, yeah, somehow I'm connected with Team 17.
Well, I mean, obviously, we'll talk more about the amazing event that you do, and also this new title as well that Alice has done the music for, Mysterious Cassette. We'll talk about that in a minute. Before we do that, I mean, going back to the kind of stuff that you did in the 2000s, you also released a product called Supreme, which looked really interesting. This allowed digital video effects on the Amiga. I mean, tell us a bit about this and why you made that.
Okay. When I was studying at university, I was working on a local TV called Tele Perugia, and they had Amiga, only Amiga there. They had a lot of Amiga 2000 with Genlock and Scala Multimedia, which was a software to create video titling. And it was working brilliantly on the Amiga. So I thought, why should I? I was always thinking that the demo effects would run great on TV. So I started to take some effects that I made and to work on a graphic interface. And I released a software called Extreme. I opened my VAT one day before an Amiga event in Italy called Pianeta Amiga. And I remember that in 2 days, we sold 1,500 copies of Extreme, which gave me all the money then to open a proper office to run Dark Age software. And immediately I said, okay, my interface and my software works nice, but I want something more. And where you can create a sort of storyboard. So first this effect, then this graphics, then this other effect, then this tunnel, then this light effect, then this texture mapping screen, and this and that. And Supreme was the upgraded version of Extreme. It was released in 2001 at the same event, Pianeta Amiga. And 3 years before, we sold 1,500 copies of Extreme, the younger brother. And during the Pianeta Amiga event, when we released Supreme, we sold something like 20 copies. So, yeah, the Amiga market was really dying, at least in Italy. And I'm very sorry, because that software is totally unknown to most of the people, but it has a lot of features. Also, you can program scripts in Arex. You can add a lot of stuff. It's compatible with the graphic cards, so you can really work in true color with super high resolutions. It has a lot of features that Extreme didn't have. And I'm very happy that you mentioned that software, because maybe now somebody will be curious about it.
Yeah, because I mean, you gave me a copy of it on CD, and I've been playing around with it, and it does look really impressive. And I think if that had come out a few years earlier, it would have been very well known. It was just bad timing, I suppose.
Yeah. I remember I was very happy, because since I was a child, I bought British magazines like CU Amiga, The One, Amiga Power, and Amiga Format. And then I saw, as you say, that the Amiga magazines were dying, and Amiga Format was the last one to close. And in the last issue of Amiga Format, they reviewed Extreme. And I was so happy, like, okay, a dream coming true.
That's awesome.
Well, you started putting on your own demo parties in Spoleto as well. What are your kind of memories and highlights of those days?
Oh, wow. Those were the times, really. We decided to organize a demo party with my friends. And I went to the city council, and they had no idea what a computer was, and especially what the demo scene was. And I started to explain what it was. Like, okay, we want to make a competition, and people from all Europe will come, and it's about creating art on computers. Something like Andy Warhol. And those were the magic words. And I remember that they gave us the volleyball stadium for free to organize the party there. And at that time, we had a team in first league of volleyball. So the volleyball stadium was like, wow, a jewel, an amazing place. And they gave us 5 million of lire. At that time, it was really a lot of money. And the event, the first year, was very, very successful. And we had all the eyes of the local community because, oh, wow, what are those guys doing? Oh, my God. It was a sort of rave party for people that normally produce olive oil or wine. So they are so far away from the computers. And then we made the other three editions, and which were, they went well. And actually, it was very, very nice to organize stuff. That's why 20 years later, I decided to organize some other Amiga events.
Well, let's talk about that kind of, because you left the Amiga scene, you said. So when did you leave the Amiga scene, and how did you rediscover it? What kind of happened there?
I was so tired of Amiga Inc. And when their plan was to release the Amiga Anywhere platform and Amiga DA, which was a sort of, yes, of Java virtual machine, then I was so angry, and I said, and demotivated as well, because the sales of our software were so low. So I was like, okay, I will close this door. It has been a fantastic time, but it's time to move on. So I stopped using my Amiga. I didn't sell it, thanks God. And I started to work on music. And I became a professional musician. And I didn't touch an Amiga for 20 years.
It was a tough time because there were lots of promises about stuff coming out. And, lots of hope. And it just kept not happening. Like, compared to today, the Amiga scene is absolutely thriving now, and there's lots of hardware and software. But back then it was very desolate, which is maybe hard for people to understand nowadays.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have to say that the Amiga scene now, not only the demo scene, the Amiga community is very alive. And thanks God, we are no more competing with PC. Now it's called the retro computing. So take the Amiga as it is, with planar mode, with the color limitation, with the only 4 channels audio. And guess what? It's a beautiful computer. Even now in 2023, it's a fantastic computer to program something or even to play games. It's wow, or to watch demos. It's such a wonderful machine.
What made you turn your Amiga back on, and were you surprised when you got back into the Amiga and suddenly the scene was quite getting big again?
I was so surprised because I was in Poland during COVID, during the lockdown, and it was snowing like crazy. It was cold. We had to stay at home. So my music career was falling down vertically. All the booking agencies I had, they closed, or they closed the contract with me. So I was like, okay, by curiosity, I called a friend of mine, and how are you? And do you still have an Amiga? And he told me, like, I have Amiga forever. And I was like, what's that? Oh, that's a package where you can, on PC, very easily use an emulator and have the feeling of a real Amiga. And I was like, wow, nice. So I bought it. And somehow the feeling of Amiga, the flame switched on again. And I was like, okay, but do you have some new games? And then he told me, like, oh, you won't believe it. There are new games every month, and the operating system is being updated, and there are new accelerator boards and a lot of magazines. And there is a new magazine in England called Amiga Addict. Look, it looks fantastic. The first issue was just released. And I bought it, and it arrived very quickly to Poland. And I was like, wow, And then I noticed in Italy, we always had a lot of paper magazines. Until 2010, we still had some magazines. One was called Bitplane. Then there was another one, Enigma Mega Life, Enigma Mega Run. What else we had? We had a lot of magazines. So I asked my account, which is the process to open a legal magazine. And he told me, like, oh, you need to have a company. And they said, I have. You need to have a journalist, official journalist, that will be the responsible for the magazine. I said, I have. So he will put the signature on the quality of the magazine. You need to register at the tribunal the magazine. And I said, how much it cost? And he told me the price. It was absolutely affordable. And you need to be registered in another list, blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay, I will make a magazine in Italian language, because we always had one magazine in our language. We need to have one now that everything is happening again. That's why Passione Amiga magazine was born.
Which continues to this day. And obviously the events that you put on as well, the awesome Passione Amiga Day, which I know is two of those you've done now, is that right? And there's more planned for next year?
Yeah, when the lockdown was over, I came back to Italy, and with some other friends write in the magazine, we decided to create an event like this Pianeta Amiga event that I mentioned before, that was every year in September. And so we organized this event, and I know how to have a place for free in my hometown in Spoleto. So we basically covered all the costs, and some friends of mine found some sponsors. So so we had everything, all the ingredients to make an Amiga event. We ran in September this year, the third edition. We had the luck to have you as one of our guests, and also David Pleasance from Commodore, Alistair Brimble from Team 17, and Mevlut Dink from Vivid Image Design. Wow, it was very nice. And personally, this was my last edition of Passione Amiga, but the other people in the magazine, they are already organizing the next edition. Probably next year it will be in Rome, so even more easy to arrive if somebody from UK is curious, for example, to spend a weekend or even more to Central Italy.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken about it on the podcast. What an incredible event it was, and just, you know, lovely people there as well, and really passionate Amiga fans. So, I'll be there next year 100%. And obviously, as we find out more details, I'm sure you'll keep us posted and we'll mention it on the show. Just quickly, I mean, because before we kind of wrap things up, Dark Age is back, isn't it? Because I know you've got a new website set up. And also, I did see that, you know, you're working with Alistair Brimble, amongst other people, on a new Amiga adventure game, which is called Mysterious Cassette. So tell us about this.
Yes. The real engine behind this project is Carlo Pastore, which is a huge Amiga passionate. He writes also on the magazine, on Passione Amiga magazine. He co-organized the Passione Amiga Day, and next year he will be the main organizer of the event. And he sponsored basically the development of the game. He wrote a book called Commodore 64, The Mysterious Cassette, which is available on Amazon in English and in Italian languages. And then he asked me, Paolo, I would like that Dark Age software exists again. And I never closed the VAT of Dark Age software. It was somehow sleeping VAT, so I reactivated it, and I found a team. So Colin Vella, which is an amazing Maltese programmer, and then I asked Alistair Brimble to create the music. So yes, Alistair is back on the Amiga after 20 wow. years. And the game, the plot of the game is based on this book. So, and the game is almost ready. It will be released before Christmas in a digital format, but also in the physical version. So it will be on classic Amiga box. And inside, we decided to don't put any floppy disks. There will be the label, so if somebody wants to copy the game on a floppy disk, then they can just apply the label on it. But we will provide a USB stick So there will be the ADF file. So if anybody use an Amiga emulator can use it, or if they use the Amiga 500 Mini as well. And inside there will be also the books in English and Italian format. So we put a lot more content than if we just release it on floppy disk.
That's the thing. There's just so many ways that you can play Amiga games these days. So that makes, I mean, for you as well, personally, you know, doing a game with Alistair Brimble, that must be like a childhood dream come true.
Oh, it's incredible. Really, life is so full of presents. Also, I have to say that I have so personal childhood memories of me playing with my dad on the game Second Samurai. And also I had the luck to meet in person Mevlut Dink, which is also an amazing person. So it was like, wow!
Yeah. And now you're hanging out with your childhood heroes. That's awesome.
Incredible. Incredible.
Well, Paolo, you know, I love your passion for the Amiga, and I love the fact that, you know, it burns really strong again these days, and you're back to making software on the Amiga and, you know, with the events and the magazine as well. So long may it continue, Paolo, and obviously we'll catch up again at the event next year. But thank you so much for coming on and doing some reminiscing with us.
Oh, thank you very, very much. For me, talking about Amiga now is such a joy, and I realized that the demo scene can survive without modem, but modem cannot survive without the demo scenes.
Yeah, you need it.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Paolo.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. And I invite everyone to visit Umbria, central Italy. We don't have the sea, but we have a lot of Amiga still now. And we are very friendly people.